Hi, science lovers. Welcome to Hooked on Science. I'm your host, Julia Cubans, and this is a podcast where we learn about cool research that you should know about. Before we jump into the episode, a little bit of podcast news. So there is going to be a new episode next week, which is not usually how things are. Usually they're bi-weekly, but next week will be a little bit different of an episode, special, I guess. It'll just be me, and I will be talking about the plant physiology behind the beautiful colors that you see in the autumn if you happen to live in a place where the leaves change in the fall. So look forward to hearing that next week. I haven't recorded it yet, but I think it's going to be a lot of fun. I am really excited to learn more about that myself and tell you about it. So if you like to hear me laughing at myself, which I am sure to do about every 30 seconds, you are in for a real treat next week. And as far as this episode goes, just an FYI, my audio is just utter garbage for the first like 12 minutes of the episode. I did the dumb thing that I do sometimes and forgot to hit record on my good microphone, like what I'm talking on right now, and was just talking into my headphone microphone, which makes it sound like a little bit like I'm underwater, but I got myself together after about 10 minutes of recording, 15 minutes of recording, and I turned that on. So I think it is around like the 12 or 13 minute mark where my audio will switch to something a little crisper and a little less under the sea. And speaking of under the sea, today's guest is Megan Holst, who is a PhD student studying marine science. She is going to be talking about her research on octopus behavior, but right now that was for her master's. Right now she is studying sharks, seven gill sharks, and she is also a podcaster. I've really been on the podcaster circuit recently, you've probably noticed, but it's been a lot of fun to chat with other people who are talking about science. Megan is one of the hosts of Sharkpedia, which is a podcast where she and her co-host chat about sharks. Unsurprising based on the title, but they read a paper about sharks and they chat with the author and ask questions about it. So if you're interested in learning more about sharks, check out Sharkpedia. Megan and I chat about it more near the end of the episode, so you can hear straight from her a little bit more what that is all about, and I will put a link to it in the show notes in case you're interested in listening. Before that, though, let's learn about octopus behavior, so I hope you enjoyed the episode. Hi, Megan. Thank you for joining me today. How are you doing?
Hi, Julia. I'm doing good. Thank you so much for having me. I'm doing great. Yeah, doing good today.
Perfect. So, okay, we could just jump right in then. So as like a kid, I feel like one of the jobs that people might come up with would be like marine biologists. They want to work with ocean creatures, right? Ocean animals. How did you get involved in this field of study?
Yeah, that is such a good question. It's like so funny because people, I'm sure you've experienced this too. When I don't usually say I'm a marine biologist because I think that is just more of like a social, there are such things as marine biologists, but I think it has more of like a social like implication than it does anything else. Marine scientist is usually what I say. And people are always like, oh, I used to want to be a marine biologist when I grew up and never did it because it just, like, inevitably what they end up saying is like it was just too hard.
Fair.
Which is true. I have also, like, I'm sure almost any marine scientist have grown up very curious about, you know, critters in general, wildlife in general, but I'm so curious about our oceans. I think very similar how some scientists are very interested in space because there's just so much that we don't know about our oceans. We know more about space than we know about our oceans.
That's what I hear, and that's crazy.
Right? And I just think there's so much there to explore. So I think the thing that intrigues me is the challenge and the pioneering of trying to find new things and new advancements in marine science. And so that's what's always kind of drove me, is this kind of pioneering of science into a landscape that we don't know as much about as maybe some people think we might. So that's really what got me into it. at the beginning.
So just as a broad question about these marine sciences and what we do and do not know about the ocean, is it like other sciences where, you know, funding is the big limiting factor to knowing more about our oceans?
Yeah. I mean, funding is such a huge issue, and it only gets harder, especially since the pandemic has started. Funding has decreased, and the demand for funding has vastly increased because so many people lost normal sources of revenue that they had during the pandemic. Funding is extremely hard. I work in shark science at the moment, and funding in shark science is even very restrictive to the species that you're looking at. So if you're looking at a species that people just don't know a lot about, you don't know what type of ecological impact it might have. If we just don't know, you're less likely to get funding. Their funders are more likely to fund something that they already know is a guaranteed problem that we might have a possible solution to. So things that we already have assessed as critically endangered. They're like, okay, we know there's a problem there. But all those data deficient species, which is, spoiler alert, most of them, they're like, well, we don't know if they're doing bad or not. And so we're just like, not going to throw funding at that. We're going to prioritize funding for the things that we know are like in a tailspin. So it's a bit unfortunate because I think the way that funding is set up at the moment, it often feels like reactive science to me rather than proactive science. It's like, let's wait for there to be a massive problem and then try to fix it, as opposed to projecting where there might be problems with species and our ecosystems and then trying to implement preventative work from it going into a tailspin.
Yeah, and I think that's such an interesting catch-22 that's so, visible across the sciences. I mean, I see that in the plant sciences too, where people get funding for the things we already know a lot about and continue, or really, really have to try hard to get funding for the things that we know less about because we know less about them. So that's, not funny, haha, but funny in the irony of that.
I was just reading a paper where even if you want to assess something as critically endangered, the amount of information that you need to assess a species as critically endangered means that you have to know a lot about their life history. Like, you need to know everything about their breeding, where they are born, what they need to eat. You need to know a lot of information before you and what their numbers are. Are those numbers declining or increasing? That is an insane amount of data that you have to know before you can even assess a population. And again, like, you kind of need funding to assess that population, but funding typically comes after you have this assessment of like, things are bad, we should do something. So that is like the caveat. That's like the one thing about science that it's like constantly this push-pull that I kind of struggle with is feeling like you have to have all this information before you can get funding to get the information that you need.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that baseline information is so critical, but it's not often as, you know, maybe sexy as some of the other topics that you want to study down the line. But
yeah, it's true.
So necessary. So thinking about marine science, did you grow up in a coastal area? Like, what originally really got your brain working in this direction? Did you go to the aquarium a lot? Like, how did this come to be, you know, your area of interest?
Yeah, that's a great question. I honestly get this question almost every time I'm on a podcast, and I honestly don't know what the defining moment was. I grew up, like, my childhood was actually in Idaho, so landlocked, although I did live on a lake, I'll say, and I grew up fishing and being around, like, garden snakes and all these critters. And I mean, when I was little, I was my sister's, like, worst enemy because I was always like catching snakes and bringing them in the house and like getting spiders and putting them in a jar to look at closer, or getting ants together and like just observing them for hours at a time. And I would be fishing and, you know, I used to eat the fish that I caught. And so I loved being able to like gut the fish and like look at all the insides and like do a necropsy. And, you know, so I was just always really intrigued by biology in general. I don't honestly know what hit the switch for me to being a marine scientist and looking at our oceans. I think that when I was in high school and just thinking about what do I want to go for college for, again, I think I'm just like kind of attracted to challenges. And the ocean just seemed like a challenge. Like there's just constant, endless challenges about trying to work on an ocean. And that I just was very attracted to that. But I don't know exactly what it was that kind of got me there, to be honest.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's totally fair. I think in some of my podcast episodes sporadically, I'll ask the person I'm talking with, like, when did you know you wanted to be a scientist? And I think people can have like similarly ambiguous, like, well, I always liked outside, or I always kind of liked this thing. And that just evolved into, you know, where they are today.
But yeah. And I think when I was thinking about a career too, I just am not the type of person that can like work at a desk and do this like kind of stereotypical 9-to-5. I was always like, I need to do something outside. And so I think that was what drove it. It's really funny because I see scientists in general always say, it's funny, I did science because I didn't want to do a desk job. And now I'm like at my desk 95% of the time, which is, you know,
the irony.
The irony is like kind of hilarious. But that 5% where you're actually outside and like getting the science and the data, it's honestly worth it. It makes up for the rest of it, in my opinion.
So going off of that, we are going to talk about your master's research on octopus behavior today, as opposed to what you're currently working on in your PhD, which is on seven gill sharks. First question, what is the correct plural term for octopus? Seems like an internet.
Yeah,
people,
I'm here to help.
Don't like it.
I'm here to help all of you. This is literally the first question I get when people learn that I'm an octopus biologist or am. I don't know. I'm kind of doing all the things now. It is octopuses. Let me make that very clear for all of your listeners. If it is multiple species of octopuses, it's octopuses is the plural. Octopi does not work because it's a Latin plural that you're trying to place on a Greek word. Octopus is Greek. You can't pluralize it with a Latin plural. So actually the most accurate Greek plural of octopus is octopodes.
Okay.
But colloquially, we kind of accept octopuses as really more correct. Octopi is just not correct. And like an octopus biologist around the world has an aneurysm every time someone says octopi.
All right. That's good to know. We're going to get a science lesson, a marine science lesson specifically, and an etymology lesson about octopuses. That is very interesting. So let the record be set straight. Octopuses it is.
There you go. One listener at a time. I'm going to get people to understand.
All right. So when you're looking at octopuses, and you were, and maybe still are in some capacity, still working with octopuses, how do you study octopus behavior?
Mm. Yeah, that's a really great question. Octopuses are very complex. And, you know, if you think about behavior and even anatomy, octopuses evolved completely separate from vertebrates. Their brains developed and evolved separately from vertebrates like us. So everything about their behavior has also developed independently from what we understand as vertebrates. And so that's kind of a context or a foundation that I try to give people, is why it can be so hard to interpret octopus behavior is because they behave so differently and have a completely different evolution of why their behaviors have arisen the way that they have. Now, it's not to say that we can't interpret it. We can absolutely start to interpret octopus behavior, but we have to remove our own biases of what we think things respond as. You have to take off your rose-colored glasses of this is how I respond, or this is how a vertebrate responds, and therefore an octopus responds that way, because that's just not the case. So really, you have to look at it as objectively as you can, the animal, and just start to catalog the things that you observe. What do you observe? If food is in the exhibit, what happens? If there's a stressor involved, like if you have to do an examination on an octopus, how do they respond? Do they move? Do they change color? You just have to start putting documenting behaviors and documenting them in the context of what's going on around the animal. And then you can basically start to create this like big catalog of behaviors of how this animal responds depending on its environment.
Okay, very interesting. So when you're observing this behavior, this is all happening like with a captive octopus. You're not like observing in the wild, or are you doing both?
Yeah, that's a great question. A lot of people do these studies in the wild for sure. Mm-hmm. I am doing them in a captive environment. So when I was doing my master's thesis, I was working with Dr. Robin Crook, who's an incredible octopus scientist. She actually studies the evolution of pain. And so she does a lot of pain studies with octopuses to show that they do have some ability to feel what we call nociception, which is the ability to feel pain. Or nociception is the ability to feel harmful or potentially harmful stimulus. And she's really brilliant. She's at San Francisco State University. So I worked with her, and she has a lab there with animals that we can observe. But I also work at a public aquarium where – and I work there full time. And so when I'm doing my graduate work, I actually double up and am working on my graduate work while I'm working full time. And the only reason that is possible even remotely is because I'm able to study the animals that are within our facility and use that as my data and as the animals, my specimens that I study for my graduate work. So mine have always been captive. You can absolutely do these studies in the wild. It's more cost prohibitive. It is harder to find them. So being able to study animals captively, while it really can be helpful to make some inferences about what might be happening in the wild, but you have an animal that you can constantly observe.
Sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And logistically speaking, that seems like it would be a lot easier than trying to go out and find an octopus and then have it, you know, in close enough proximity and not have it go somewhere else, you know, while you're trying to observe it, and or introducing stimuli and, you know, having competition maybe from just the environment that it's already in. So when you are looking at your octopuses, it feels like, you know, the word moist for some people, it's just like it doesn't come out quite right, and I don't have when you are looking at your octopuses, are you looking at like a single species of octopus, were you looking at a single species, or were you looking at, you know, multiple different species to see if there are any differences in behavior to a certain stimuli?
Yeah, really great question. So first, what I'll say is, you know, behavior was part of my research, but I was actually doing a lot of physiology work and how the physiology of the octopus compared to their behavior, which is super, super interesting and happy to get into. For my master's thesis, I specifically was looking at the giant Pacific octopus. And then I'm actually still working with octopuses. I don't know why I hesitated about that before. I do still work with octopuses, and right now I'm actually replicating some of the study that I did with giant Pacific octopuses, and I'm doing it with red octopus, and then comparing if red octopus will display a similar physiology response that giant Pacific octopus do.
Maybe this is too nitpicky of a question, but like, what is the difference between those two different species? Like, why would you choose those two to compare against each other? Or is that just like what you have on hand?
It's what I have. All right. But also, they're both cold water Pacific species. So they're both species that overlap an environment. So you would find them off the coast of, well, they both kind of are found from Alaska down to Southern California. I'm going to say that loosely. Giant Pacific octopuses, I will say, need colder water. So when you get to California, those giant Pacific octopus are going to be in deeper water, whereas red octopuses are often intertidal, so they'll be in tide pools. If you go to Alaska, where it's much colder, you can also find giant Pacific octopuses in the tide pools. It's like cold enough that they can be in shallow water. So it's interesting to compare them because they're in similar environments. They're in the same ocean. There's obviously a huge size discrepancy. If you don't know what these species are, I absolutely recommend looking them up. Giant Pacific octopus is the largest species recorded. They can get very large. On some of the largest that have been recorded are around 150 pounds.
Oh my gosh.
That's a really, really, really large octopus. I have worked with a few that are around 100 pounds, and those suction cups, let's see, like what's like a saucer plate, like a if you're having tea, the saucer, it's like,
yeah,
they're very large, maybe up to 5 inches wide is just the suction cup.
Wow.
Of that octopus. They're very large animals, whereas red octopus, they max out much smaller, like softball size, like their whole body can like fit into a sphere of a softball. So they're similar but different.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, size wise that sounds like an enormous range between them for sure. Yeah. And if people are interested to see what these look like, I'll post photos of them when I post the episode. I'll either, you can send me some, Megan, or I can just find some on the internet and have a little visual aid to go along with it. So if you want to know what they look like, go look on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
Cool. And so talking about octopus physiology, I actually have some questions that were submitted from another podcast, Knowing Nature Podcast, and they wanted to know if we know how the octopus beak evolved and how that came to be. And maybe this is, you know, a totally different area, but do you know?
I don't know. And I will say, yeah, octopus biology is so interesting when you start to get your foot into the door of octopus biology in general. There are so many scientists and they're all siphoned off into very, very specific aspects of octopus research. Like some people just specialize in eyes. That's all they do is just look at the eyes. Wow. Some people just look at the brain. Some people look at both, like the eyes and the brains, because there's obviously correlation there. Some people just study their skin. Some people are just doing like behavior. It is so interesting. There are so many subcategories of octopus research. I don't necessarily know how the beak evolved. It's a really great question. You know, the shell, obviously, all octopuses have like a vestigial shell. We still see it in like the nautilus or paper nautilus. They obviously have a shell. If you look at a paper nautilus, it actually just looks like an octopus that's just like carrying a shell around. They're like somewhat, I think they can actually detach from their shell. So the octopus has obviously like lost their shell, right? They're a mollusk and they eventually lost it. You can still kind of find a vestigial shell in their mantle, actually. Like a little tiny little fragment that supposedly is like a vestigial shell. But the beak, I'm not so sure of. That's a really great question. I don't quite know how it evolved. It's a really good question. It's like, well, it's the only hard part of an octopus's body, as I'm sure you probably knew.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, an octopus can squeeze through any crevice that's bigger than its beak, which is its mouth.
Yeah, I have seen some crazy videos on the internet of octopuses, I don't know, being on like the decks of ships and going through like a teeny tiny hole in the side and just, you know, this huge thing, you know, being in the water all of a sudden seems like a good escape plan to have as just any kind of animal.
Yeah. Not having bones can be beneficial in the ocean.
For sure. And so, okay, also speaking of the beak, another question that we got from Knowing Nature Podcast is, do octopuses have a sense of taste?
Yeah, they absolutely do. Yeah. They have really great chemosensory capabilities. They do, I think, are able to taste with their mouth. They have a radula in the middle of their beak that they use to kind of like a tongue kind of. But their chemosensory in general, they actually can taste with their suction cups. So they have really intense chemosensory capabilities in their body. Octopuses, you know, they kind of see and they experience their environment in like this 360 experience, very unlike us, right? Like our eyes are faced forward. We can see what's in front of us. We can taste and we can smell some certain things. Octopuses are very, very sensitive to what I'm saying is chemosensory. Anything that you could taste or smell in the water, a chemical cue, they pick up on those things very, very quickly with very sensitive chemosensory cells, especially within their suction cups, which they use to explore their environment. So if they find something, if their arms will kind of work independently because each arm has their own brain. An octopus has nine brains. Oh my gosh. If you didn't know that.
Yeah. No.
Okay. So octopuses have nine brains. It's like, there's like, I have like a fact sheet of, like, that I sometimes go through, especially with kids. And nine brains is one of those things. So an octopus has a main brain, the central brain, that's in the mantle where you would think it is, like kind of behind the eyes. But then each arm at the base of the arm also has a brain. We call it a brain. It's a really complex set of nerves that have like brain capabilities. And it can actually control each arm independently without even telling the central brain necessarily what it's telling the arm to do. So those arms can go off on their own and explore the environment and experience the environment without telling the central brain necessarily what's going on, unless it's important enough to be like, hey, central brain, there's something over here you should look at. And then the central brain can coordinate all the arm brains together to go towards like food or to escape from a predator, et cetera. But each one of those arms is constantly getting information about the environment and deciding, you know, whether or not it's information that the central brain should know about.
That is so cool. I had no idea. And I mean, talking about the different arms being independent, I have definitely seen other videos of an octopus, you know, I don't walking, swimming, I don't know, but kind of like moving all its arms. Okay, well, you can't see if you're listening, but I'm just kind of like wiggling my fingers around and it's like going. Yeah, that's so interesting. And okay, this is kind of an offshoot of that. So if an octopus, I guess a two-part question, loses one of its arms, can it, you know, survive and, you know, patch up that wound? And does that affect, like, how would that affect the behavior, or would it, I don't know, would it be like totally disoriented not having one of those brains at its disposal? Or is it just kind of like, all right, that's gone. The rest of the arms kind of fill in the hole.
Yeah, great question. Okay, so first, with the brain part of that question, the brains are in this like ring of brains. It's kind of in the main body part. So if you lose an arm, you're not necessarily going to lose that arm brain. They can regenerate their arms. It depends on whether or not they decide to regenerate an arm. I have seen like young octopus. The giant Pacific octopus, they will regenerate an arm, but maybe if they're older, they might not necessarily, because now they're gearing all their energy towards reproduction. But they can absolutely survive like nothing ever happened without their arm. It happens actually very frequently in the wild, and actually even with mating. I don't know if you're familiar with octopus mating. I
definitely am not. So
okay. Yeah, so this has mating implications. So I'm gonna like we're gonna talk about mating for a second. So we'll put our arm question on the back burner.
Sure.
We're gonna talk about mating and then we'll get back to that. So octopus mating is super, super interesting. The way that you tell males and females apart is that males have what's called a hectocotylist arm. Or hectocotylized arm. They have a hectocotylus at the end of their arm. It's always on the third arm to the right. So if you look at an octopus on the top of their body, they have four arms on each side. And the third arm going from the front of their mantle or their eyes to the right is their hectocotylized arm if it's a male. Now you can find the hectocotylus at the very end of the arm. And it lacks suction cups, and it's a little bit more swollen than the other tips of the other arms. So it's a little bit more fat, and it doesn't have suction cups. And that is a really important organ because they will actually hand over a spermatophore to females. I don't know what your audience is, but this is maybe like a 10 and up conversation.
Okay, yeah. It's an adult audience, so
okay, great. Okay, cool.
We could keep it, you know, not too R-rated, but you know, you can talk about things as they are.
Okay, we're going to talk about, you know, octopus sex biology. So sure. They have, a lot of people ask me, you know, is that their penis, the hectocotylus? It is actually not. The male octopus does still have a penis inside their mantle. They have a testes, just one, where they produce all of their spermatophores. And then a little gland will push the spermatophore, which is literally this long spaghetti looking strand that has a helix of sperm inside of it. Mm-hmm. I like am not doing this justice because I honestly think spermatophores are this very, very, very cool biology thing, because it's like literally this packet and there's this perfect sperm helix on the inside, and I've never seen anything like it. It's very cool.
That's crazy.
Look it up. It's very cool. So the penis will pull the spermatophore out of the testes and like out of this gland, and it comes out of the penis. But then it is will go down this groove on their third arm, and it's actually this like muscle that palpates and moves the spermatophore down their arm. And then the hectocotylus, if you look at it really closely, can actually split open like a pea pod. Like if you look at a pea pod, how a pea pod kind of separates open. That is kind of how a hectocotylus works, and it will kind of like inside that little pea pod enclose the spermatophore. And then when it finds a female, which they can smell because they have, as we discussed, really good chemosensory capabilities, it will like stretch its third arm towards the female and like put it inside her mantle. We still are like unclear at how they know where to put it, because it does seem that they know the hectocotylus might have maybe some additional chemosensory capabilities or something. We don't really know. But it puts it where it's supposed to go. The female can then store that sperm packet for as long as she wants, and then she'll digest that packet and introduce the sperm to her eggs when she feels like it, which is amazing.
Wow. Yeah, that sounds like a really interesting mating ritual, I guess. Yeah. Or just
it's so
the whole
cool
process. That's so interesting.
It's so interesting. And then a female can take spermatophores from multiple males, and then she could like just choose one. She could fertilize all of her eggs with different genes, which obviously has some advantages in terms of evolution and mixing your gene pool. It's a bit unclear. That I think that field of research is still fast and wide open for those that want to look into those kind of things, but it is very, very cool. So that being said, the male tries to extend his arm and like give her the spermatophore, and then like tries to get out of there, because the females will make that male their last meal if they can, because then the female basically stops eating. When she wants to reproduce, she'll go into what we call senescence, where they go anorectic and they stop eating. They lose a lot of weight. And if she can have one last meal with that male octopus, she might. So it is very common for octopus to lose their arms, whether it's through mating or whether it's just from a predator. If they can hand over an arm and get their arm chewed off rather than their whole body, they will. So some species, especially like tropical species that are on a reef and there's lots of predators around, you can see them going around with like three full arms and five partial arms.
Oh, wow.
And that's like pretty normal.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they're just living their lives regardless of their arm lengths, it sounds like.
They're so adaptable. That was like the longest response I possibly could have given you for that one question, but I was like, there's a cool story behind this.
That's totally fine. Yeah, no, that was fascinating. Okay, so pivoting back to the research that you were doing, the research that you're currently replicating, what would a typical day in measuring octopus behavior look like?
Sure. So when I was doing my master's thesis, the thing that I was studying, which I'll start with, is their senescent phase. So I just kind of touched on that with their reproduction. And males and females both go through what we call senescence, where they enter into this reproductive phase and they only reproduce once and then they die. It's like the end of their life. Very
for
similar.
For both male and female of the
For both
species?
Male and female, they both go into senescence. They both both male and female can mate with multiple individuals, but once they go into senescence, that's it. Like once they enter into that senescent phase, they don't leave it. Like it's the beginning of the end.
Sure.
And similar to salmon, like how if you've ever seen salmon swim upstream, it's a very, very, very cool thing to observe. I've only observed it maybe twice. And if you ever see female salmon swimming upstream to spawn, they're quite literally falling apart, right? Those females spawn their eggs and then they die, and their bodies, their carcasses actually provide a really incredible nutrients to the riverbed, which feeds then the babies. So it's this very like sacrificial circle of life type of reproduction.
Yeah, wow, very, I had no idea.
Yeah, it's very similar with octopus, where they start to basically break down. They're not necessarily, the babies don't feed on the mm-hmm. adult, but they go into senescence and their bodies just quite literally start to break down, right? The female stops eating. The males also will stop eating, although it's a little different. And they just start to basically kind of decompose in real time. And so what I was really interested in was what is going on with their physiology or how their body operates when they're going into that phase. And in particular, is their welfare compromised when they're in that senescent phase and when they're nearing the end of their life? And are they experiencing pain or mm-hmm. nociception? Because their skin can get really friable and it just starts to break apart. Like their skin just, it just starts to, yeah, fall away and break apart.
From start to finish, how long does this senescence phase take? Mm.
Yeah.
Does it depend?
It depends. It really depends. It depends on the sex. So females, I would say, probably have a longer senescent phase than males, because typically females are brooding eggs, where males are just like finding females, mating with them, and then they die. So I find that senescence is a bit quicker for males with, mm-hmm. I think it is certainly dependent on species. So I will only be talking in this context with giant Pacific octopus. But with giant Pacific octopus, it typically for males is like 2-3 months, whereas females is like 8 months. So it can be this long time that you're taking care of them, that they're in this like end of life phase. And so what I wanted to know is, are they feeling the whole extent of that experience? And if they're feeling that experience, at how much is that impeding on their welfare or their well-being? And so that is a really big question, especially for animals that we can't interpret from.
That sounds like a huge question.
So whether or not you have an octopus in your lab or if you're at a public facility, knowing what that animal is experiencing is really important for their well-being. We need to know how to care for them in this like kind of critical part of their life stage. Mm-hmm. So what I would do is a few things. I was measuring in general their, you know, things like their appetite, their stereotypic behaviors. Are they pacing? Like sometimes octopus, this is a blanket statement. Please don't think that you can interpret octopus from this, but sometimes they can pace back and forth erratically when they start to get into that senescent phase because they're looking for a mate and maybe they can't find it. So they're like, where's the mate? Where's the mate? That's like literally all that their brain is now consumed with reproduction. They stop eating and like literally the only thing they can think about is mm-hmm. mating. That's like the only thing on the brain.
So is that like when they reach, you know, sexual reproductive maturity, this phase is just kind of triggered?
No, yeah, great question. So they are sexually mature actually pretty young. I think there was a paper published saying, I could be wrong about this, so please don't quote me on it, but I think that most giant Pacific octopus are sexually mature within the first year, or within like 2 to 3 pounds, I think was what I read from the literature.
Oh, wow.
But
especially if they reach 150 pounds, that's really early.
Yeah, but if they are, they enter senescence once, which that cascade of hormones happens in the optic nerve, which is the nerve behind their eye. And so it's based on time of day or the daylight cycle. And so okay. It typically happens at the beginning. It's like spring, early summer when senescence happens typically with giant Pacific octopus. But whether or not, like I have no idea why an individual may or may not succumb to senescence 1 year or not. That's a really great question. I think it could have to do there are so many variables that we could think mm-hmm. about. Like if they're stressed, if they think that they might die, if they think that there's a strong predator presence, then they might try to go and flip that switch and go into senescence and go ahead and reproduce because the environment is not safe. If they're like in a really cushy area where there's no predators and they're feeling safe and there's lots of food, I don't know. Maybe they will wait a year. This is speculation. I don't actually know the answer to that, but I think it's really interesting. Whereas if you look at tropical species, they typically are born, reproduce, and die within a single year.
Okay, that and is so, a live fast, die young yeah, lifestyle.
Tropical species are like getting it done right away. Giant Pacific octopus and red octopus are also the longest living species of octopus, and they live 3 to 5 years, which is still
that
pretty.
That was my next question, was in you know, the grand scheme, how long is this whole cycle? So it's still not that long.
No, not at all. So when I go to measure their behavior and physiology, which is what you originally asked, is, you know, there's a few things I'm watching for, which is those signs of reproduction. Once those have been indicated, I have a matrix that I actually published that has a lot of different categories of indications or signs of stress and or senescence, because sometimes symptoms of stress overlap with signs of senescence. So I made this really detailed matrix that kind of goes over all these different possibilities. And if you hit a certain threshold in certain and multiple categories, then you're probably looking at senescence. So that matrix really helped me start to quantify the behavior of where my animals were at in their life cycle. And then I would take a couple different things. I would take a biopsy. So I took a few biopsies of when the animals were healthy, of the ends of their arm, so that I could have something to compare to with the same animals from when they were senescent. And then as they were going, actually their whole life, from when they were healthy all through senescence, I had these little tools that helped me measure what we call nociception, which again is that ability to feel harmful or potentially harmful stimulus. Okay. We use nociception as a proxy for pain, which means, you know, we actually are still trying to describe pain in other species. We can talk about our own pain because you and I can like put a number to it or describe our pain. That is very personal. Pain varies a lot depending on the individual, which is why two individuals can have the same injury but have very different pain experiences from that injury. So with animals, we have a really hard time being able to quantify their pain experience, or if they're experiencing pain, which is an emotional response that we often apply to a physical trauma. That emotional part is how we experience pain. And we're just not quite there yet in science to know if animals experience pain the same way we do. And if they do, how do we measure that? That's like a whole other field. That's what my master's advisor is looking at. But we can measure nociception, which is, again, how they might respond to something.
In order to, you know, quantify this or like get an idea of what a reaction might be, how would you go about doing that?
Yeah, great question. So I had these tools. They're called Von Frey filaments. They're these little nylon little filaments. Like if you have a hairbrush that has a lot of little nylon things coming out of the hairbrush, like that, except they're in different densities. We use those Von Frey filaments to basically touch an animal and apply a certain amount of pressure to the animal. What I mean by that is I know that based on the density of a filament, they've been calibrated to apply a certain amount of force when it touches something. When the filament bends, you can like basically put a constant amount of force at the very end of that filament because the filament bends, and then the actual force that's applied at the very end of that filament stays constant. And the amount of force that is applied to something with that filament depends on the density of the filament. So I have some that are calibrated for like 10 grams of force. So if I touch the animal, the filament bends, I know that exactly 10 grams is being applied to that animal where I'm touching it, as long as the filament is bent, that is like absorbing the additional, like obviously wavering the force.
Extra
of my
pressure.
Hand.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. So I had like 5 different filaments of different densities that were applying force from 0.16 grams, which is like nothing. It's like, yeah, it's like your hair touching your finger. And I think 60 grams was my largest filament that I only used on larger animals. Mm-hmm. And I would touch them at the same point over their whole life. I had a few different points that I would touch them at. And then I would just rate their response. How did their behavior respond to that point of pressure when I put it on them? And what I'll say is that when they're healthy, they don't respond at all. They're like, okay, why are you touching me? Do you want to interact? Are you giving me a toy? Are you, you know, they're just like healthy and they don't seem to respond at all.
Yeah.
They don't seem to have like a nociceptive response, meaning that it doesn't seem to be potentially harmful to them. They're like not experiencing it like that.
I can imagine, you know, just as like a person, if somebody, you know, pokes you with something pointy or with too much force, you kind of like recoil. Is that what you might also see with an octopus or?
Exactly. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. It's like what I expected to see is if it was nociceptive, that I would touch the animal. Like if I was touching their arm would withdraw really quickly. Like, I don't like that. When they're healthy, I wasn't seeing that, which was really interesting. Sure. And without giving too much away, what I'll say is that that definitely changed during senescence. They were feeling some things, but not like I expected at all. We found out some really, really cool stuff. We correlated how they were responding to those filaments with that behavioral matrix that I continued mm-hmm. to do throughout their whole life. And we correlated basically this graph of how they responded behaviorally and physically. And then we compared these biopsies of their actual nerve cord, of their mm-hmm. health, to see how healthy their nerve cord was over time. And then we got to correlate all those things. And it actually told a fairly nice story. So definitely be looking out for that publication. I'm excited to get it out.
Yeah, that sounds like it would be, you know, a really well-rounded, I don't know if that's the right, you know, term for it, but project where you could say like A plus B equaled this thing over, you know, X number of samples, whatever that may be. But we can leave it at kind of like a cliffhanger of their results at this point.
Yeah.
And maybe have a, once that comes out, maybe we can have a follow-up where you
Absolutely.
Can talk about that.
For sure.
So if you are looking at octopus and they are, you know, senescing and eventually dying during this, what kind of challenges does that introduce to doing research?
Yeah. So, you know, giant Pacific octopus are large, as we've discussed. And so mm-hmm. you're limited based on space, how many you can have. So I think for my research, I only ever actually applied this research to maybe 4 individuals. So to get enough samples that was statistically anything, I actually coordinated facilities across the United States and Canada that replicated my procedures and also provided biopsies. And then actually it's really important to see what the variability is between individuals, not only individuals of the octopus, but individuals of the tester. Do we get the same result depending on the animal and whoever is applying the test that we're applying to the animal? And we did. We saw consistent trends with all the animals of the samples that were provided and the people that also, I would send them Von Frey filaments and they touched their octopuses for me over their lifespan. And we saw very consistent trends.
Wow. Yeah, that is, I feel like sometimes not easy to get in science and scientific research to, you know, see consistency across sites and locations and people, but that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't perfect by any means. There is no perfect data set, I will say. It was certainly not perfect, but we had enough of a trend to be able to make some conclusions for sure.
Okay. And so I think before we move on and chat a little bit maybe about what your podcast is, to, you know, mention that if you want, are there any takeaways about your octopus research or just octopus in general that you want to leave people with?
Oh, man. You know, octopus biology and research is a big and growing field. Actually, it's kind of a small field, but growing. Mm-hmm. And I will say that it's like super, super exciting. If you're interested in octopus, there's absolutely space for you to research them. There's so much that we're still trying to learn and understand, especially with their physiology and especially with like their neurobiology, their nervous system. There is definitely room for people to come in and compare species. There's so many species also that we could compare and look at. And there's only really been a number of species looked at really closely. So I would just say if you're interested about an octopus and if you're looking them up and you can't find information about them, it's because we just haven't found it yet. So you should do it. You should be a marine scientist and do it.
Nice. Yeah. If you are listening and you're interested, get on that. It sounds like just from what we talked about today, there is plenty of room to learn and grow in this octopus research field. But you don't just talk about octopus. You don't just look at octopus. You also look at sharks, and that's one species of shark is your, I think, PhD topic currently. But you're not just researching sharks. You're also talking about sharks. And you have a podcast, Sharkopedia?
Sharkpedia.
Sharkpedia. Okay, I wasn't sure if there was the O in the middle. But Sharkpedia, do you want to give a little, you know, descriptor of that and what you talk about, what someone could expect if they check out an episode?
Yeah, absolutely. So my co-host is Amani Weber-Schultz. She is also an early career shark scientist. Her and I are both going through our PhDs at the moment. Both of us have shark research experience in the past, and we really like shark literature. We also like what we call SciComm, which is science communication, which is what we're doing right now.
We sure
we're communicating science. And we really like SciComm. We really like sharks. And we're early career, so we need some opportunities to network with other shark scientists. We also need to stay on top of the literature. And so I had this idea of, like, you know, why don't we create a podcast where we're breaking down a shark article, a shark research article, and then interview the actual author and ask them questions about their paper, which we almost never get to do in science, and even get our listeners to be able to ask questions to the author and get to hear about what it was like designing their experiment, obstacles that they faced, things that you don't necessarily get context for when you're reading a research article. Also, research articles can be really hard to read. And so we basically provide some context for our listeners so that, you know, if maybe if they read the article, they can get a better understanding, a more well-rounded understanding of the article. Or if they haven't read it, they can glean and walk away knowing what the subject matter was of the article, why that research was so cool, without having to be a specialist. So our audience is definitely not shark scientists. It is shark scientists, but it's also a lot of people that are just curious about sharks and don't necessarily have access to scientific articles or don't know how to read them. So we interpret them for them with the authors. We ask them questions about what it's like to be in the field. We ask them for what we call a field story, where they tell us some funny stories of being out doing shark science, and we've had some really funny ones. So yeah, that's what they can expect, is just to, like, learn about actual shark science from shark scientists and hopefully have a good time doing it.
Yeah, that sounds great. So if anyone listening is interested in learning more about sharks, learning more from Megan and her colleague and other shark scientists in the world, definitely go check out Sharkpedia. But before we wrap up, do you have a fun field story that you want to share?
Oh, that's a good question.
Just turn your own question back around on you.
You know, okay, so my co-host actually asked me this on our first episode that we recorded. It caught me off guard. I should have been ready for it, and I wasn't. And honestly, I think I'm going to keep this response, even though it's maybe not the funniest or anything. But honestly, the field story I like to share is the first time I got the first shark on board and got the first samples of my study. That experience is really profound to me. I felt very much under pressure as a young scientist, you know, thinking about the question I wanted to ask, what samples I needed to get, getting the approval, getting the funding, coordinating a team, coordinating a research vessel to go out and find the animal, which we were having a hard time doing for a while. We were researching seven-gill sharks, and they just were a little bit later that season than I was anticipating. And when I finally got one seven-gill, I only got one on that day. I was hoping for multiple each time, only found one, and that is fine because that is all it takes, is one single individual to get on board and actually start your study. And that moment I just will always hold dear to myself for the rest of my life, because it was the moment I actually felt like a shark scientist. I had a shark on board. We got the samples that we needed. It went really smoothly. And then we released the animal, and it was in really great condition when we left, when the animal left. And that, like, watching the animal swim away with the data I needed to answer questions about the entire population or the entire species was just, like, really, really, like, reminded me of why I'm doing this in the first place. So mine is less, like, funny, anecdotal, more inspiring. You know, that it's – if you're a scientist, you know, look ahead for that data, because once you finally have even a taste of it, it makes everything worth it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, like, the excitement and, like, kind of the reward of doing that, and probably some of the validation to, you know, get that data and have your first set of data points. I can imagine that being a really exciting experience and something that would be memorable.
Yeah.
But to wrap things up, if people want to either learn more about what you're doing or if they want to follow your podcast, what social media can they use to find those things?
Yeah, you can find me on both Instagram and Twitter at Meg Holst, MEGHOLST. At Meg Holst, I'm on Instagram and Twitter, and I usually post about my research and some of the stuff I'm doing. Sometimes my dog makes it in there every once in a while, who you may or may not have heard growling in the background today. And Sharkpedia is – oh, hold on. Let me actually pull that up. Sharkpedia, you can listen to Sharkpedia anywhere where you can find podcasts. Our handle for Sharkpedia is Sharkpedia Pod, P-O-D, at the end, for both Twitter and Instagram. So you can follow us there, and we always post our updates when we have an episode release – and some cool photos of the guest scientists actually doing the science that we're talking about that day. So yeah, look for us there.
Perfect. That sounds great. Well, thank you, Megan, for talking about octopus and a little bit, just a teensy bit about sharks. And it was really delightful to hear more about your research.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
If you want to follow Hooked on Science on social media, you can do that on Facebook and Instagram by searching at Hooked on Science Pod, and on Twitter by searching at Hooked on Science. Thanks for listening.